glinting off their titanium limbs. Then, outside, he saw the fire tornado dancing madly, a zillion embers rising like the city's every selfish prayer, up into the night. "Dear God, please take this cellulite from my thighs that I might know beach readiness. Holy Lord, that I might fly private until the end of days, and so be closer to thee." They carried him through his front gates, out onto Hummingbird Lane. They laid him in their Humvee, a hybrid model bought from Soldier of Fortune magazine. Carrie shivered as they unzipped their fire suits. Most had shaved their heads, Marine style. Their arms were strong and toned in olive tank tops, shoulders broad and powerful, like an Olympic volleyball team. Even their prosthetics seemed advanced, superior. One woman wrapped him in a fire blanket while another pulled aside his bathrobe, jabbing his left buttock with a syringe. "What did you give me?" asked Carrie, suddenly woozy. "Just a little happy sauce, all natural from the poppy fields of Topanga Canyon," said the woman who'd injected him. Bathsheba Brenner. She had joined ROTC at Harvard, an active service to prepare for a career in government. Then, as a Green Beret fighting ISIS in Iraq, she decided that terror was the new activism. A sedative ease oozed over Carrie as the car screeched away from his house, radio scanning police and fire frequencies. "The Getty's fucking burning! Tanker to Bonhill! Tanker to Bonhill! I've got 30 men pinned down here, and..." The radio cut to terrified screams as the Humvee reached sunset. Before them, taillights stretching for 1,000 hopeless yards, then vanishing into a Netflix red haze. Carrie's lungs burned. He retched up a plug of ash-heavy snot. A titanium hand offered him a bottle of water. He looked up into the delicate face and twinkling almond eyes of the hulking commando who, as a man named Salvatore Marinelli, had been an aimless dog track gambler and who, as a woman named Sally May, had found renewal in organic gardening and ethical bank robbery. "Yeah, suck it down," said Sally May, winking playfully. All up and down Sunset Boulevard, police struggled to maintain order, laying down magnesium flares, explaining to a sinewy bleach blonde in head-to-toe Fendi that her claims to the Jif peanut butter fortune notwithstanding, she'd have to wait this out with the rest of them. "We're all even now, bitch." Up ahead, a family abandoned their Subaru, father hauling suitcases, mother carrying a wailing infant, their little boy holding his toy lightsaber at the ready, like he might protect them all. His mother reached to cover his eyes as, tearing through the traffic just behind them, came a man wearing only an IKEA bag with holes cut for his arms and head. He squeezed his scrotum like it was a clown horn, yelling, "Honk, honk," as he weaved among the cars. People briefly forgot their predicament, stretching up their phones, flooding the already overloaded satellite system with Instagram shots of his bouncing septuagenarian genitalia. Then the air stilled before rushing up the escarpment where the fires roared ever hotter, ever higher. Carrie looked across the street to the Brentwood Inn. Its trysting residents were visible in the windows, some hurriedly dressing, placing calls to the loved ones they'd been betraying just moments before. A few staring horrified down Sunset as a jet of purple propane flames shot up from the street like it was a giant Bunsen burner. A shockwave rolled through the cars. "It's the gas mains," said Willow, a West Virginia trucker's daughter who joined the Marines for college money, had twice saved her unit in Fallujah before losing her right leg to an IED, and joined the daughters after the medical bills bankrupted her family. Chunks of flaming asphalt rained down on the Humvee's roof. "Shit," said Carla, a strikingly beautiful black woman, a sergeant's daughter and West Point graduate who started each morning reciting lines from the Iliad while doing 100 one-arm chin-ups. The loss of her left arm to an Afghan mortar attack had ended her combat career and plunged her into a clinical depression. She'd met Bathsheba on Twitter, had found her will to live restored by the younger woman's theory that they could still serve America's spirit by preparing for its political system's inevitable self-destruction. They're all gonna go. Agonized screams, people burning in their cars, seeding chaos and havoc. Those with enough horsepower made for the median strip, the sidewalks. A Ford pickup on monster wheels knocked over a series of parking meters like bowling pins. Carla joined the demolition derby, slamming hard into a Kia just ahead of them, issuing commands. Bathsheba, flash grenade, right between the Yukon and that Sentra. Carrie watched Bathsheba pull the pin free with her teeth, admired the juxtaposition of her soft pink lips on the dark military steel, the carefree grace with which she lobbed the grenade from the side window. "We prefer non-lethal measures," said Bathsheba to Carrie as they made their break. "Saw enough death in the desert wars." She peppered a stubborn Mercedes with rubber slugs from a 12-gauge, shattering its back windshield as Carla gunned the Hummer up on the Kia's hood, crushing the car to foil as they rolled onto Kenter. "Christ," said Carrie, afraid, confused. "What are you doing?" "Strictly speaking," said Sally Mae, "this is a kidnapping." "In the middle of a fire? Gates open, doors unlocked. We never let a good crisis go to waste." "Why me?" "'Cause we like you, Jim. We really like you." "You kidnap me because you like me?" "We've found that if done right, kidnapping can be a positive experience for everyone," said Bathsheba. "We started with Silicon Valley guys as a way of financing ourselves, keeping pace with the latest in prosthetics while also protesting big tech's ceaseless predation on our privacy and dignity." "It felt right at first, but they got crazy tedious," said Carla, swerving to avoid a Volvo. "Big, entitled babies. They start screaming the moment you take them. So you gotta duct tape their mouths, which triggers bullying memories. And they start shaking and pissing themselves. So you gotta hog tie them. And that just makes it worse, because guys on the higher end of the spectrum hate being touched," said Sally Mae. "Some got so anxious they couldn't perform for us." "Perform for you?" "After capitalism eats itself, we'll have to rebuild," said Bathsheba. "For this, we'll need good seed. A man like you can plant that seed." With these words, a twanging boner took form beneath his bathrobe. Trying to keep his head in the apocalypse, he thought of his Brentwood neighbors, soon to be forced from their estates. Where would they all stay when every 5-star hotel was booked? There were stories in years past of people checking into the Ramada Inn, fighting over slivers of melon and tiny croissants at the continental breakfast. A sobering thought, and one that had its desired effect, his arousal subsiding as Kenter became Bundy. Then they turned onto San Vicente, charging over the median strip of burning coral trees toward the Brentwood Country Club. The Humvee roared up a craggy access lane, then onto the course, kicking up chunks of highly valuable earth as it churned up the fairway. "This'll get us clear," said Carla, "and its back rose to Topanga." "Topanga? We've got a safe house there." They joined a slow-moving convoy of SUVs that had smashed through the club's chain-link fence from San Vicente, now a vein of fire. Carrie pressed his face against the window. "Founded 1947, said the club's greeting sign, before vanishing into the flames. Ash and embers murmurating in the ruby sky. They passed a Buick SUV, its chrome rims amber with reflected fire. A red-headed girl in the back seat recognized Carrie and started waving excitedly. Her guilelessness was touching. He replied by curling the corners of his mouth toward his eyes, then arching his eyebrows up at a sinister angle that grew and grew until the girl recognized this as the face of the Grinch and lost all fear of fires in her giggling. They ripped across putting greens, forded an anemic stream, drove finally past a sand trap where someone was still golfing, trying again and again to smack his ball up onto the green to complete his game. Carrie craned to see the maniac, recognizing him as his manager of 20 long years, Al Spielman II, seemingly at war with the earth itself, smacking, cursing, each swing just burying the ball deeper into the sand. Wait, I know that guy. What guy? That guy. There's no guy. Stop the car, said Carey, who for all their differences still cared for Spielman, wished him well. You seem to misunderstand the captor-captive power dynamic, said Carla, pulling clear of the trap, leaving Carey to watch as a black smoke curtain billowed across the fairway, erasing poor Al from sight. We change, said Sally Mae, setting her titanium hand on Carey's shoulder, the mighty woman's empathy so deep it seemed that he could feel it flowing through her alloy fingers. Sometimes we do leave people behind. The radio crackled to life, a warped static that surged and subsided, fragmented and reformed, over and over, metamorphosing each time toward the sweetest music Carey had ever heard, notes whose healing power surpassed even that of the sacred solfeggio tones he had piped into his hyperbaric chamber. Change the frequency, said Bathsheba, and Willow did, but the music reappeared as if paired to the vision that now appeared in the western sky, a single shining disk. It seemed at first a star, magnified by a raindrop on a window, except for how playfully it flitted along the pattern of a perfectly equilateral triangle, and how much larger it was, even in the distance, than any normal star, how its light didn't glimmer so much as pulse. What's that? Asked Bathsheba, pointing up. Drone? Guessed Willow. That's a giant fucking drone. Maybe a weather balloon? What are you, Operation Blue Book? Said Carey. That's a fucking UFO. Cyborg commando women and fires and calls from my dead dad and now a fucking UFO? Who's doing this? Who's doing what? Ignore him. Just drive. It could be TPG. Mused Carey. Who's TPG? TPG owns CAA, and they own my digital essence, and probably yours. They got 100 giant mainframes out in the desert. This could easily be happening in one of them. A computer simulation? Why not? Because we just pulled you from a burning house, asshole, said Carla. We're real goddamn people, people who've suffered and lost and been changed by suffering and loss. Our pain proves that we're real, said Bathsheba. Ever feel the limbs you lost? Asked Carey. Don't go there. But you do, right? Phantom pain in legs and arms that have been gone for years. Sometimes people feel things that aren't there. Give him another injection, Bathsheba. I actually think he's making sense. Carey's iPhone vibrated in his pocket. Give me that, said Sally Mae, then saw the caller's name. It's Nick Cage, she announced. Should we let him take it? I don't know, said Bathsheba. He reinforces oppressive tenets of systemic patriarchy. Actually, I think he's hot, said Carla. And his deeply expressionistic acting perfectly captures the madness of our age. It's no mistake that his technique draws from Germany in the 20s. He's a seer. I more than agree, said Willow. Cage is like the Chuck Yeager of the dramatic arts, breaking through barriers once deemed impassable. All right, said Carey. Can I have my phone, please? You're a goddamn hostage, said Willow. We'll control the communications. I don't know, said Carey as Cage rang to the voicemail. If TPG's buying up digital essences, they probably got Cage's, and they'll just keep torturing us until we take the call. They'll throw awful things at us. They'll take away the people we love and give them the phone, said Sally Mae as Cage called again. He's spiraling. Fine, said Carla. Put him on speaker. And no dicking around. So Sally Mae accepted the call, flooding the Humvee with the atonal horror of Nicolas Cage singing gaily from the beloved Christmas carol, Do You Hear What I Hear? Way up in the sky, little lamb, do you see what I see? Nick, a star, dancing in the night. Yeah, we see it, said Carey, eyeing the spacecraft. We're all looking right up at it. I've seen this before, man, in my Malibu memory retrieval. I know, Nick, I was there. Where are you now? Right now, I'm with the Daughters of Anime. The Feminist Commandos? Fucking cool. Yeah, they're all right, said Carey. Anyway, they're kidnapping me. We're going to Topanga. Shh, you'll never make it, said Cage. Topanga Canyon's a kiln. You don't belong up there unless you're fucking ceramic. And this flying saucer? I know these guys. I've seen their gross, snaky faces. They've been following me across the globe. I bought 10 houses to get away from these squirmy motherfuckers, but they just kept showing up. I spent so much dough refurnishing. It really stank. Ugh, said Bathsheba. It's all about him. Take that back, spat Cage. Whoever you are, you take that back. I won't. Look, I'm known for playing the reluctant hero, but don't think you can kick me around. Shit's about to get... Cage inhaled, then, on the end of the phone, for his own reasons, struck 5 dramatic and angular poses before booming operatically. Raw! And the government won't listen to me because apparently buying a black market meteorite puts you on some kind of fucking list. So I haven't chosen this, okay? This is a weight that's been thrust upon me, crushingly. His voice quavered, softening the hearts of the daughters of Enemy. Come to me, Jimmy, Cage concluded. All other roads lead to death. A burning knot of palm fronds fell onto the windshield. Where are you, Nick? At your house up in Malibu. Why? You said I could stay here. When? Last month. I meant for a day or two. Yeah? Well, necessity is the motherfucker of invention, man. Come to Malibu. Take the old pining path to Santa Monica, then drive up the beach from there. What's the pining path? Asked Bathsheba. A system of back roads to the beach, said Carrie, who had taken this route during his brief but joyous affair with Pamela Anderson in the summer of 1996. Lovers used them during the days of the morality code to avoid being seen as they left town. The tide's coming in now, said Cage. The water will keep you safe. It's your only option. Topanga's burning, confirmed Willow, checking fire feeds on Twitter. Then we don't have a choice, said Sally Mae. Hurry, said Cage, and Godspeed. So they drove down the fairway, past the blazing clubhouse, out through the smoldering front gardens. Then they turned onto Baltic and took the old pining path, weaving through neighborhoods of frightened people hosing down their lawns, gathering all their valuables. Soon they reached the Santa Monica Pier, planks and pilings straining under hundreds of evacuees. Medics triaged burn cases. Restaurants handed out meals. The famous Ferris wheel was empty but still spinning, purple neon slicing through the smoke. They muscled for a mile along the Pacific Coast Highway, then, up ahead, saw the rear edge of the Topanga fires. Even Willow, who'd killed 17 during the Battle of Fallujah, gasped to see the hills all garish tangerine. It looks like a napalm strike, she said. The traffic was locked all down the highway, forcing them on foot. They cleared out of the Humvee and walked onto the beach, trudging heavy with weapons and ammo, past stray dogs and horses, soaring palms burning like torches atop the escarpment, lighting their way. Then, amid a city in grievous pain, struggling against the rising surf, body strained beyond capacity, Carrie collapsed of exhaustion. So Sally Mae, who as a free safety for Staten Island University could bench press 400 pounds, scooped him up. He wrapped his arms around her neck, felt her augmented breast against his cheek. He closed his eyes, drifting into sleep for just a moment before startling. Georgie, he gasped. She's safe. She's in Puerto Rico with Lin-Manuel Miranda. How do you know that? I follow both their Snapchats. Now relax. Then the firelight refracted off the woman's titanium prosthetics into Carrie's dilated pupils, stretching and feathering into full-grown angel's wings. Just outside Malibu, they saw what had stopped the northbound traffic. A 60-car wreck where the canyons ran nearest to the sea. And as the sirens screamed in climax, an Exxon tanker truck gave up an eardrum-blistering blast, gas flames vipering in all directions, engulfing, once again, a casino bus dense with carbonized bodies frozen in struggle, mouths agape mid-shriek, faces twisted in pain, hands seized in clawing actions. There'd been a rush to the ocean, The strongest had made it to the rocks at the top of the beach and died there in a pile. The rising surf had cleared a sliver of safe passage just beneath it, wet sand defying flames. And here the sea carried away the dead. Accountants, plumbers, schoolteachers, and artists. Breaking waves turning them to common slurry. Carey clung to Sally May as she carried him over the surf, seeing people from his past among the remains as the waves rolled in and took them away. There, curled in a tight U, in a khaki suit and brown tie, he saw his Uncle Jim, for whom he'd been named, a jeweler who, for his Catholic confirmation, had given him a penknife engraved with an ancient saying, "This too shall pass away." The surf rolled in, pulled away. He saw, half buried in hot pants and a star-spangled tank top circa 1989, the early fitness guru, Richard Simmons, hands clutching a bag of powdered sugar donuts. The surf rolled in, pulled away. Another body, eyes pure fear, a platinum wig dangling from bobby pins. Helena San Vicente, tossed by the tide, and then swept away. Carey's old faith now rose over all later existential musings, his lips suddenly making prayers like the nuns had taught him, Hail Mary, full of grace, something deep inside still believing that these words could conjure real magic, could summon the Virgin Mother of an Aryan man-god to protect and guide him. He prayed with tragic hope, at once telling himself that the daughters of Anami were the avatars of angels, and wondering why his mind was wired to believe in a soul. He prayed not once, but many times, as Sally May carried him over the heartbreaking sand. The Malibu colony's lights came into view, among them those of his own house, where Nicolas Cage, standing watch on the second-story sun deck, sighted them all through binoculars. "Dare forward," he cried, thrusting his hard-won medieval sword toward the heavens. "All that you were sure of, you must now leave behind. The hour of contact is upon us. Time to see all sides of the diamond." Chapter 14. The patio was fringed with razor wire, piled with sandbags. Carey entered his house exhausted, stomach cramping from the miles-long walk, throat and lungs burning from smoke inhalation. But he would find no immediate peace. A crate of Uzis sat on the kitchen island. Over in his breakfast nook, Sean Penn, Kelsey Grammer, and Gwyneth Paltrow were all seated Indian style, struggling to assemble a shoulder-fired missile system whose many components lay scattered around a crate marked Armed Forces of Angola. Stinger reprogrammable microprocessor is a dual-channel ultraviolet tracking seeker and proportional navigational guidance missile system, Gwyneth read from the instruction manual, sipping a glass of rosé. The spectral discrimination of the seeker detector material when supercooled by the argon gas in the battery coolant unit. She searched among the scattered components, then, with a playful smile, picked up a tiny steel bulb, wondering aloud, "Is that this thingamajigger?" "No," said Willow. "That's the oscillation modulator." She walked over and joined them, taking parts from the pile, expertly snapping them together, making more progress in a few minutes than they had all night. "Where are the rockets?" "In the bathtub," said Gwyneth. "What?" said Carey. "The fuck are you doing?" "We're preparing for battle," said Kelsey Grammer, wearing an outfit entirely stolen from the 20th century Fox wardrobe department. A Napoleonic overcoat, a World War II-era steel battle helmet bearing four Patton-esque stars. And something of Patton's spirit possessed him as he looked up at Carey and, borrowing from Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket, snarled, "Why don't you jump on the team and come on in for the big win?" "That's good," said Carey. "You got that down." "Why, thank you," said Kelsey, relieved. "I felt good running the line in my head, but until you hear it out loud, you just don't know." "We were watching the fires with Natchez when his place burned down," explained Sean Penn, wearing Vietnam battle fatigues. His third eye saw something his other two couldn't handle. Guy's on heavy benzos, not taking it real good. He's been making the same sound for 2 days now. Mmm, groaned Natchez, catatonic, on the sofa. It was now clear to Carrie that Nicolas Cage had exceeded all reasonable definitions of beach home borrowing, had, rather, affected something far closer to wartime requisitioning. Someone had thrown a bale of razor wire on the daybed. Crates of hand grenades were piled atop the dining room table. A flamethrower leaned precariously against a 30-pound gasoline tank. A bank of laptops purred on the kitchen island, a number of half-eaten vegan chicken wings scattered among them. "Fuck you do to my house, Nick?"
"Like John the Baptist," said Cage. "I prepare the way."
"What's this gunk on all the windows?"
"Silicone shatterproofing."
"Why would the glass shatter?"
"'Cause we buried landmines in the side yard."
"Fucking hell, Nick. You know I'm anti-violence."
Even Arjuna had to heed the call.
"Don't you throw the Bhagavad Gita at me."
"Mmm," again Natchez moaned, like a bear many days in a trap. Carrie turned to see the stricken guru's eyes bulging in their sockets. "Something in there's trying to get out," said Cage, then turned to the daughters of Enemy. "So, you're the leftist commandos?"
"Eco-terrorists," said Carla.
"It's a distinction with a difference. We could sack Exxon's world headquarters with the hardware you got here, and probably have some left for at least a raid on Monsanto. Where'd you get it?"
"El Chapo," said Sean Penn.
"He owed me a favor."
"What's your story?"
"I was 101st Airborne, Carangal Valley. Willow and Sally May here were both Marine snipers, 87 kills between them. And Bathsheba ruled half of Baghdad before the scales fell from her eyes. How about you boys?"
"I once played a two-star general," said Kelsey Grammer. "It was primarily a boardroom comedy, but Variety said I projected real authority."
"I was in Thin Red Line, Taps, and Casualties of War," said Sean Penn, stubbing out a cigarette on his forearm. "Took basic training for all those roles."
"And you were great in them," said Carrie.
"Powerful performances."
"I wouldn't know," said Penn. "I can't watch myself."
"The point is, we'll need to. We can hold our own," said Cage. "And I've spent the last year in deep research, monitoring transmission from the Boötes Void."
"Fuck's the Boötes Void?" asked Sally May.
"It's the Great Nothing," said Carrie. "I've seen this on YouTube. It shouldn't be there. And yet, there it isn't. A massive stretch of empty galaxy."
"Yeah," said Cage, eyebrows popping wildly.
"Or at least, that's what we thought.
But now we know the emptiness was just a ruse, the stealth technology of an awesomely advanced civilization. They've been transmitting information. It's just so highly encrypted, it flows right through matter. These are the bastards who've been following me my whole fucking life." His voice broke with pain. "I fought these reptiloids 1,000 times, across eons and multiple lives. Not an eternal recurrence, nah, that'd be too kind, as a kind of torture. Along the way, I had a pretty good film career." His tears at least seemed real, a description maybe of his frustration with typecasting, or maybe a sincere reaction to this story he'd adopted as a personal faith while all other faiths crumbled. Carla felt real empathy for this man, for all men, as a silly species of wayward children playing at specialness. "Nick's last claim to past lives is not scientifically verifiable," said Gwyneth Paltrow. "But the rest checks out. We've captured the transmissions. Amazingly complex. They cloak themselves by bending light. Only a dynamic, recursive neural algorithm can unbend it. Thankfully, I've learned to write those while running Goop."
"You learned algorithms from running a lifestyle website?" said Carrie.
"I was motivated by the website," said Paltrow. "I learned at MIT.
"You went to MIT?
"Absolutely," said Paltrow. "You can do anything online. But that's unimportant. What matters is this. The hour of contact
has arrived. With a sound of tearing Velcro, Cage produced a remote control from inside his trench coat. He cut the house lights with one click and opened the living room's retracting ceiling to the night sky with another. Then the Oregon eco-terrorists and the Hollywood actors gathered close in the darkness, gazing up in wonder at the glowing orb. "Maybe they're friendly," said Carrie, "like neighbors coming over with a fruit basket." "Friendly is a word they forgot long ago," said Cage, doing an Elvis-inspired karate kick. "Gwyneth, you want to show them?" Gwyneth Paltrow logged into the computers, explaining, "I'm tasking a satellite loaned to me by my good friend Elon with scanning the space around that disk. Don't be shy. Come closer." They gathered around her monitor. The screen filled with an image of the sky above them. "This is our world as it currently seems," said Gwyneth Paltrow. Then, with a flurry of keystrokes, the image changed drastically. There was no longer just one glowing object, but many, all around it, legions of light bulbs hovering right over their heads. "This is our world as it actually is. We count over 500 of these craft, more arriving by the hour, gathering over Tokyo, Sydney, Paris, and almost every other major city on the globe." She zoomed in on one ship, the images at resolution, showing its perfectly streamlined form, beyond any human power of construction. "Who are they?" asked Carrie, voice suddenly boyish. Again, from the sofa came the agonized mmm sound, formed by a psychic landslide within the person of Natchez Gushu, who, whole body seizing, slowly extruded the word of his horror, "Monsters!" Then, in a great failing pulse, the images of the saucers dissolved from the screens, leaving behind just an unremarkable night sky. "They know they've been seen," said Bathsheba. The next morning, Carrie woke early and lay in bed, scrolling through his iPhone. Twitter reported news of UFOs over 20 major cities. NORAD had scrambled fighter planes up and down both coasts. The Pope was broadcasting a prayer for peaceful encounter from the Vatican, where theologians worked furiously to reconcile scripture with the visitation, debating whether the spaceships were piloted by angels or demons. The Scientologists had no such quarrels. For them, the saucers were ultimate validation. They were promoting a viral Instagram tile that said Ron was right, and calling senior members to their headquarters in San Jacinto, where a neon-lit UFO landing circle had been constructed, a buffet of champagne and truffled mac and cheese laid out, 1,000 chairs arranged for an outdoor screening of Battlefield Earth. And while Carrie could accept every mad bit of this news, he was, after all, a man who had once spent many nights trying to free his soul from its presumed residence in his upper thorax. He was disturbed by what followed. An ad consumed his screen. It started with trombones playing sliding scales, honking each note like a sneeze as the camera went close on a familiar nose, a nose dripping mucus and owned by a digitally perfect Marlon Brando. Set in eclipse lighting to suggest the character of Kurtz from Apocalypse Now. He blew hard into a Kleenex, opened it to ponder its contents, then turned to address the viewer directly. "The horror, the horror, the horror of nasal congestion. I'm Marlon Brando. I did some pretty good acting when I was alive. Many considered me the best. But I'd have been even greater if I'd had Mucinex." With the popping of a pill, he was instantly healed, cheeks in high color, song welling mightily from where only phlegm had been just moments before. He took a deep breath, turned, velvet curtains parting behind him to reveal a packed Broadway theater, everyone cheering and throwing roses. He gracefully picked one up, held it to his nose, smelled it. Then a cut from Brando to a bottle of Mucinex in its own tiny spotlight at stage left. A single rose landing perfectly in front of it as the ad cut to video of light spheres dancing over Jakarta. Riot police swinging billy clubs, brutally repressing a crowd of 10,000 terrified souls. Carey pocketed his phone, slightly more depressed by the digital whoring of Marlon Brando than the plight of the 10,000 Jakartans. He walked downstairs. Gwyneth Paltrow had taken the guest suite. Sean Penn and Carla were sleeping on air mattresses, Natchez Gushu and Willow on the living room couches. Carey had been trying to cut down on caffeine for several years, but now that struggle, like so many others, seemed part of an abandoned world. He made himself a coffee, stepped out onto the porch. Kelsey Grammer and Bathsheba had drawn morning guard shift, but somewhere along the way had traded vigilance for wonder. Their Uzis lay forgotten in the sand as, holding hands more like schoolchildren than lovers, they stared awestruck beyond the waves where the front line of an alien armada hovered little more than a mile overhead, barely disturbing the ocean's surface, emitting a rose-gold glow against the water, this light falling brilliantly over every grain of sand on the beach, seeming to calm the waves and the fires in the hills. It filled Carey with an abiding peace as it washed over his face, accompanied by the sweetest sounds he'd ever heard, the hovering spaceships emitting a divine harmonic that passed right through you in healing waves, freeing you from all fear, all shame, all dread. Carey felt the dissolving of an inner weight that had grown so heavy he'd forgotten it was there. He felt a deep and connective presence in this moment, no dissonance between soul and body. It was a harmony so totally consuming, he hardly noticed the animals lined up all down the beach. Horses set free from Malibu stables. Zebras and ostriches escaped from private zoos. House cats and dogs, birds flown down from the hills, all had gathered to the shore, great and small necks alike, craning up at the armada, chirping, braying, eyes closed, like ur-beasts beseeching Noah, or retirees on morphine at an assisted living center, depending on one's view of the arrival. "The light pleases them," said Kelsey. "It pleases us, too. It's like Prozac." Bathsheba laughed. "And late June." Carey angled his head to receive a maximum dose of the magical light. He thought of the Atlanteans vanishing into otherworldly glows. "The animals aren't afraid," said Bathsheba. "Why should we be?" They walked up the beach, followed by paparazzi angling for dream shots of celebrities, animals, fires, and flying saucers all at once, barking inane questions. "Hey, Jim, what do you think of the flying saucers?" "Is this really what you want to be doing at the end?" asked Carey. "What else would we do?" The images were selling for so much money, they didn't stop to consider that money would soon be worthless. They flashed away as the actors and eco-terrorists strolled past the Malibu colony homes, patio pools, and hot tubs become wildlife refuges. Stray llamas sipped from Sting's waterfall, while a family of emperor penguins bobbled and splashed in his jacuzzi. "You're ruining the splendor," snapped Kelsey Grammer to the paparazzi, "and you're harassing these noble animals." "Those guys bothering you?" boomed an avuncular voice from down the beach. Carey turned and saw Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks, flanked by a trio of private firefighters and a duo of burly security guards, yes, but still, Tom Hanks. It was impossible to hear him and not feel some restored faith in human goodness. "Morning," said Kelsey, "and a fine one at that." "It's like the first dawn," said Hanks, gesturing to the animals lined up down the beach, basking in the sweet light, the alien armada just beyond them. "Or the last one. Either way, I feel like a billion bucks. Hey, is that Jimbo?" "Hey, Tom," said Carey warmly. "You stuck it out?" "Fire department got overrun in Mandeville." Hanks shrugged to acknowledge his extensive private bodyguard. "Had to fight it out ourselves."
Private security is the death of democracy, said Bathsheba. A return to the Hobbesian state and an affront to people's dignity.
Who's that? Said Hanks.
That's Bathsheba, said Carrie. She's been radicalized.
Good for her, said Hanks. Want to come have breakfast?
Here was another major star, an actor of his caliber, and in other ways beyond him. Carrie had long marveled at Hanks's mastery of the industry, his easy sachets down corridors of power. Had Tom Hanks sold his essence, too? If so, that was at once reassuring and disconcerting. On the one hand, it meant it was probably the right business play. On the other, who was the star here? Because with Cage involved, and Penn and Paltrow and Kelsey Grammer, and all the daughters of Anime, who could easily be millennial actresses unknown to him despite massive Instagram followings. Well, that suggested many harvested essences that had been smooshed together, the film a head cheese of digital personas. And as Carrie had read no contracts, had essentially traded his spirit for the promise of a nap, well, true horror now fell over him, deepening as they walked to Hanks's sprawling veranda. What if they'd given him a supporting role?
Honey, we got guests, yelled Hanks to his wife, Rita Wilson. It's Jimbo and Kelsey, and this one.
He pointed to Bathsheba, closed his eyes.
Bathsheba, can we get you guys something? Coffee, mimosas?
A cappuccino would be delightful, said Kelsey Grammer. Mimosa, said Bathsheba. Jim?
Jim?
Coffee, said Carrie, absently. He wasn't paying attention, was entranced by laughter coming from down the veranda. His heart raced. He felt rare nerves as he turned to see, sitting on a wrought iron patio sofa, filming the orbs with a digital camera, a titan of his industry, eternal wunderkind, father of the modern blockbuster, and now, undeniably, a prophet of some kind. Steven Spielberg. Spielberg looked up, face wild with joy, turning the camera on Carrie as he approached, whispering like he was narrating a film. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping things, and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. His camera went close on Carrie's face as the star surveyed the armada. They spanned the horizon now, 1,000 ships. Maybe more. As the optics zoomed, Carrie felt all existential panic subside. Where was he? He was where he'd always dreamed of being, before Steven Spielberg's camera, planted, fixed, affirmed, not just by its presence, but for how its aperture overrode the chaos of the world, fixed the scene, the moment. He imagined himself not as he was, but as he appeared in Spielberg's eye, and in this imagining felt possessed of definite form. Enlivened, that was the word. And there was another just beyond it. Completed. Reality and fantasy had converged almost entirely, and here he was in the viewfinder of the great secular mythmaker. Enlivened, yes, completed. No need to search for words, to wow with comic genius. He'd prepared for this in hours of late-night TV watching. He was ready. Genesis meets Revelation, said Carrie, nodding to the gathered animals, the iridescent ships. The beginning completes the end. Beautiful, said Spielberg, then with a giddy chuckle. And isn't it also possible, Jim, that the end offers a new beginning? I've never seen you so happy. My dreams have come to life. Is there any difference between life and dreams anymore? Asked Carrie. Have you seen this Brando commercial?
Mucinex gave the grandkids $50 million, Spielberg said ruefully. We've been post-human for a while, I guess. Doesn't matter now.
Come see. Carrie sat and peered through the lens, zoomed in close on the nearest ship. It was so perfectly formed.
Spielberg panned along the craft. No joints, seams, or rivets. A slender, miracle, radiating light. It's like a Brancusi. I don't know what Brancusi is, said Carrie, but I'm sure it's very nice. I'm just saying that they must value beauty to make such gorgeous machines. He looked to his wife, Kate Capshaw, approaching with a tray of her famous challah bread. Oh, wow, here it comes. Challah, boomed Tom Hanks, taking a piece of the warm bread from the tray. Spielberg pulled back for a two-shot as Hanks handed Carrie his coffee, then settled into the chair just beside his and clearly playing to reclaim what must have been a deeply gratifying monopoly on the master's lens, said, We've had darn good lives. We did darn good stuff. We're all flying down over the Hudson River now. We're coasting past the moon in a wounded craft low on oxygen. But I'd rather be here with you guys, with Kate's warm challah bread, than in that bunker with Leo and Toby and those lingerie models. He spoke with a lump in his throat. Rather be here, tossing around a Nerf football, frying up some burgers and hot dogs, lighting sparklers, with Jimbo and Kelsey, Steve, Kate, Bathsheba, then running from this thing, whatever it is, wherever it's from. He fought back tears. Just want to say that. They're beyond our knowing, said Rita Wilson, rubbing his arm. It's okay. Spielberg's camera lingered on them. Portrait of a husband and a wife. I never expected humanity was really going to matter very much, said Carrie. The camera panned to him. To look for any meaning in it is a ridiculous thing. The vastness just laughs at you. How's it go? Matter makes up 3% of the universe. The rest is dark energy or dark matter or whatever. They don't know. They were never going to know. Things grow and die. Fungus on a tree. Lavender in a field. What's the meaning of lavender in a field? I'm okay with the meaninglessness. I'm okay without meaning. But we made our own meaning, didn't we? Said Hanks. We gave it to each other as a gift. I see what you're saying, said Carrie with a shrug. Spielberg pulled back for a low-angle two-shot of the A-list stars, neither wanting to argue, each appreciating the other's viewpoint. Why didn't we all get together sooner, said Hanks, while there was time? Ask TPG, said Carrie. Who's TPG? Asked Rita Wilson. TPG owns CAA, said Kate Capshaw. Spielberg panned down to the silver tray, where the crumbs of his wife's challah bread danced ever more wildly as the spacecraft's tones grew louder. Hanks turned toward the sea, eyes flaring with fright, watching as the ships moved. Then, with the others, he looked back to the table where, amid the music, all the sweetbread crumbs had self-arranged into a perfect, vibrating, geometric form, which awed them even before, in a gasp, Spielberg identified the pattern. It's the tree of life. Then the breadcrumbs scattered into disarray as the alien harmonics met interference from nearby speakers, a manic voice booming. Check, one, two, check. Yo, you ain't got the answers. You ain't got the answers. Everybody listen up. The animals let out startled wails. I am the alien's emissary to all mankind. Who is that? Said Jim. Kanye, said Tom Hanks. They all left the veranda, plodded up the sand alongside the paparazzi to find Kanye West standing on the sun deck of his sleek modern beach house, wearing a pair of silver mirrored contact lenses and a titanium crown set with emeralds in the form of an Adidas logo. He preened and posed for the news drones, stretching his arms up toward the sky as if to bless and welcome the alien fleet. Spielberg, Hanks, and Carrie drew little more interest than a group of passing llamas as, from inside the house, preceded by full camera crews from Fox, CNN, TMZ, and E, came Kim Kardashian. Wearing a pearl tiara and a silver bustier with flying saucer breast cups, she held a frightened child in her arms, caressing him as Kanye played to his iPhone camera, live-streaming to the billions for whom he was, by that late and raving hour, Earth's most viewed extraterrestrial news correspondent.
"You need not be afraid. They speak to me in supernatural verses. I am one with their jam," said Kanye, tapping his titanium crown.
"This is what's happening."
He gestured to the frightened baby squirming in Kim Kardashian's arms.
"The alien angels hath laid with Kim. They filled her womb up with the star child."
Kim Kardashian held the baby up for the cameras. He wore a gold lame onesie from the Baby K Child's clothing line, of which, at the age of one, he'd been elected CEO by a unanimous board vote. The company had just been sold to Qatari investors. The baby, now one and a half, was worth $700 million. "Why were you chosen for this?" asked the CNN reporter. And all prior history and logic felt to Jim Carrey like a garbled dream, as Kanye explained.
"In another dimension, I'm a dodecahedron named Cake. And I was going to kill the aliens, but I didn't. So they honored me here, told me I'm the archangel and Kim's the star mother, gave us the star baby."
"It's very humbling, to say the least," said Kim Kardashian.
"How did they give you the baby?" asked the CNN reporter.
"They entwined our DNA," said Kanye, "synthetically."
"How did they contact you?"
"They called me."
"From where?"
"Palm Beach."
"I thought they spoke to you through your crown."
Then Kanye West, drawing upon his full powers as a freshly minted archangel, commanded the flying saucers to disintegrate the CNN reporter in his place. When that didn't happen, he burst into tears.
"These are higher intelligences," said Spielberg. "They'll either love us unconditionally or coldly annihilate us. One thing is sure, they don't explain themselves. They don't hold press conferences." A light drizzle began to fall. The glow from the ships passing overhead brightened as all cell phones and televisions, any screen that streamed data, pulsed to life, all receiving the same broadcast. It began with a title screen, a brief introduction to planetary cancellation, which dissolved to a live shot of a figure beyond ethnicity, beyond gender, a taupe-skinned study in pleasing aesthetics, guaranteed to evoke affinities across all cultures, counter to Spielberg's assurances. Tan Calvin would now explain himself.
"Earth has been one of our most beloved and longest-running programs," said Calvin. "Eden was beautiful, but dull as dog shit. Doldrums. The program wasn't working for us as viewers or for you as characters. We introduced conflict. When Cain bashed Abel's head in, we knew we had something. Of all the spheres, our people tuned in to yours. The Fall of Babel was so good we gave it a sequel, this time with twice the towers. Holy Wars. Of all the programs across all the galaxies, Earth was the first to discover that oxymoron. And some would like to watch you atomize one another, but the ratings board and certain professional codes won't allow that. And so I'm here. I have come to take you home, and in these remarks, I shall inform you of the best practices for a planet in your situation." The rain fell harder as Calvin continued. "I am putting out the wildfires in California to show you that, almighty beyond imagining, I am kind. Take it as a token of good faith as we conclude this deeply gratifying programming experience." The spaceships froze above them, a great craft hovering just down the beach, others arrayed in a perfect grid, one every 5 square miles. And through the mist falling down off the hills, shooting down from every ship with triumphant blasts, blasts like angels' trumpets, came pure beams of the same golden light Carrie had felt that morning, but now so much stronger, filling the world as music played from the ships. The same healing frequency, but now with definite harmonies. Like Barber's adagio, raised to a cosmic power healing all wounds in fast time. It soared as the rose-gold shafts thrust down from the spaceships, Tan Calvin imploring, "Walk into the happy light. Be free,
be cleansed, freedom from concerns, from bills to pay, from grief and sickness, no bodies full of pain, no one to impress, no loss of any kind, only cleansing light, forgiveness. This is our parting gift to you, eternal aching bliss. Kim Kardashian, star baby in her arms, left sobbing Kanye to be the first human assumed. She kicked off her high heels, jumped off the patio, and, remarkably fleet of foot, she dashed toward the light field, a dozen cameras following. She stepped inside the glow, fell to her knees, and began to moan. Then her moans turned joyous, and she began to rapture. "She's going up ass first," said Kelsey Grammer. And it was true. Kim's early ascension was a bit wobbly. But then she learned to work the beam, floated heavenward like a true angel, pressing the star baby to her breast, spinning with ecstasy, followed by the cameras that broadcast the moment worldwide, #StarMother, #StarBaby, and #FollowThatStar, began trending as Homo sapiens embraced its own demise. First went the lonely, the empty, the ill. Also surprisingly, large numbers of those who had seemed to be living perfect lives, but had, in fact, been secretly totally miserable. Images spawned and multiplied, the rapturees' faces suggesting that not only was this painless, it felt awesome. Within moments, worldwide, millions were rushing for the lights, crowding the Champs-Élysées, prison guards rapturing alongside inmates as orbs hovered over penitentiary yards, whole families ascending from the Rio favelas, disregarding all prior faiths to embrace Calvin as, if not quite a messiah, a reliable manufacturer of miracles. In Malibu, the stars were mesmerized, watching in disbelief as Kim Kardashian hovered 30 yards between the ocean and the saucer. So many were eager to join her, to cast off the millstones of their invented selves. Some raced so fast into the lights that they missed the last piece of Calvin's offer, didn't see how his tongue flickered, lizard-like. To those who resist, to them shall be great suffering. Children gnawing at their mother's entrails, bodies roasting over slow fires, then bodies eaten raw, then hunger and cold, all shall know, horrors not yet seen by man, until he is no more. Looking up from the broadcast, Carey saw Spielberg speaking on his phone. "Ready the Amblin 12. We'll be there in an hour." "What's the Amblin 12? "A spacefaring escape pod, Jim," said Spielberg guiltily. Beyond a certain point, toward the end, it was the only really fun thing for us billionaires to spend money on. "Can I come with you?" "Sorry," said Tom Hanks. "It's a real compact module, and Oprah needs a seat for her emotional support animal." "What about throwing around the Nerf ball? What about grilling hot dogs?" "We'll bring videos of those things and treasure them," said Hanks. "Anyway, it was great brunching with you, finally. Okay. We got to skedaddle." "Let them go," said Kelsey Grammer consolingly, as the Spielbergs and Hankses traipsed down the beach. Each must meet the end on their own terms. And, for both men, the sting of exclusion gave way to spinning wonder as other celebrities poured from all parts of the colony. Tearing for the light, decades of auditions and rejections filling all with the fear of failing to make the cut. Lindsay Lohan went up like a kite on an April breeze, crying, "Yippee!" before colliding with Diana Ross. Then they grasped hands, steadying each other, maneuvering to accept Keanu Reeves. All linked arms, singing one last crowd-pleasing refrain of Ross's 1970 hit, "Reach Out and Touch Somebody's Hand," soaring up like skydivers and Rewind. But the greater ecstasy was Kelsey Grammer's. He walked into the beams with Bathsheba and felt deep within him that at last, with this felt 20-something commando, he'd found it, pure love. Holding hands, they swirled skyward, and words rose from within Kelsey, truths of love gifted to Juliet by Shakespeare, lines of such beauty that men had forgotten their genders entirely while speaking them at the Globe Theater. Lines that he'd longed to speak since Juilliard, but had always been denied him by the strictures of his day. "My bounty is as boundless as the sea," he said as they daisied over the Pacific. "My love is deep. The more I give to thee, the more I have, for both are infinite." "That's so beautiful," said Bathsheba, tears filled with golden light. "You really think so?" said Kelsey. "I thought I was pushing." And then they were Twizzlerized. Maybe, thought Carrie, this was all Lanny Lonstein's masterpiece. Or maybe he was in a luxury nut house, pissing through a tube. Or maybe he was overdosed in a Vegas hotel, this nightmare but a final blabber of the dying cerebral cortex. The surrounding world offered no explanations, no proof or disproof. It was content, smugly so, to simply be. He recalled a Bible passage about when the stars would fall from the sky, later seeing on YouTube that indeed this would happen. The galaxies would spin so far away from one another that all would be cold and dark. What was wilder than that, or bleaker? Oblivion was coming for them all, worse than any Tsar's army. Here, above him, were strong ships leaving port. Why get fussy about the owners, the destination? The light pulled him toward it. The music called, too. Carrie felt all inner beasts quieting as he dared his foot inside the light field's outer edge, then passed his whole body through. This was real. Only this. The little children shooting up like bottle rockets. The grief-heavy soul struggling up like weak-old helium balloons. All concern was fading now. The smoldering hillsides, the distant city, sad shadows. The only place was here, the only time now, as he stood on the sand, awaiting his ration of the miraculous. A giddy tickle spread across his every cell as Cher and Dolly Parton whizzed by overhead, both singing Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, a deep wanting to join them. And just like that, his feet left the earth. Weightless with joy, freed of burdensome memories, delighted by happy ones, which became his total awareness. Grilled cheese sandwiches, chasing a puck across a frozen lake. His mother in high color, healthy, jolly. Instigating dinner table food fights. It was understood when she made her special cherry cheesecake that half was to be eaten, half to be thrown. Glistening airborne cherries and her melodic laughter, which he realized now had become his own. His brother John had matured early, was fully developed by age 10. Carrie and his sister Rita would ambush him in the shower, finding him in full pubescent bloom, mortified as they pointed and sang, "Hair, hair, long, beautiful hair," performing in the living room, aged 8, jokes landing, his father turning to the guests, saying, "He's not a ham, he's the whole pig." Waiting on the balcony of their apartment to see his father driving home in his new car, a brown Vauxhall, to Carrie's young eyes, a marvel of engineering and achievement. The car in which, one summer, the whole family drove 400 miles to see the Sleeping Giant, an island in Thunder Bay that looked like a resting Indian chief. Drawing as a boy, cartoons he made, a man called Marvin Muffinmouth. A train to Sudbury, 6 years old, drawing Marvin Muffinmouth, walking up the aisle of the car, showing Muffinmouth proudly to the other riders. The kitchen table where, age 2, he contorted his face again and again, resisting a spoonful of pureed cauliflower, sending his family into hysterics, discovering a gift and a weapon. You must understand that Jim Carrey and all the others on that beach, they were very happy, meeting better ends than nearly all of the 100 billion souls who'd come and gone before them. better than death by Spanish steel, better than most of them deserved. And for Carrie, it all grew better still as he heard a voice calling him back. Linda Ronstadt. She was 36 again, a Mexican princess.
Volver, volver, she sang,
suddenly right beside him, holding his hand. Come back, she whispered as he laid his head against her chest. As he became, for the first time in decades, entirely unbothered. He was the space of contact between his cheek and Ronstadt's skin. He was Ronstadt's fingers in his hair. He was the music of both their voices singing,
Volver, volver, come back,
Then, a sharp clawing around his ankle is down below on the fifth try. Nicolas Cage, Sean Penn, Willow, and Sally Mae succeeded in lassoing him with 200 yards of climbing rope. There followed an angry, violent tugging as they yanked him away from his bliss, as if Carrie were an updrafting zeppelin. He resisted, seeing the rope as a slithering boa constrictor, kicking and flailing, struggling mightily back to Ronstadt, toward the candied nothing that lay beyond her embrace. But finally, they landed him, dragged him thrashing from the light field, and pinned him down on the sand. Linda, he bawled again and again, pained by his broken rapture as they carried him back to his house and laid him out in his bed. Chapter 15. Entering the rapture beam was euphoria, and being yanked out left Carrie's mind frail and fuzzy, able to grasp only the faintest wisps of experience, present and past. Natchez Gushu's bone-white body bobbing in a bathtub, vertical slashes down the wrists. The ammonia stench of smelling salts. A plastic spoon full of macaroni and cheese. Then some clarity returning. Linda Ronstadt was lying beside him. She'd been watching him